You set out at twilight, at the start of your holy time of day, the night time. The plastic bag of dried food in your right hand and nothing in your left. No phone, no suitcase filled with no quizzes to grade, no keys, for your lock was busted. The super said he would fix it Thursday, but never mentioned which Thursday. You had no cigarette. You'd quit once a pack of smokes reached past $10. If only soaring prices could get you to quit any bad habit. Like dating the married women with the large husbands you'd met only once and wordlessly by the force of their knuckles against your cheek. And rising rates never really pushed you to drop the cable TV package that brought you slot after slot of dreck, a midnight routine of climbing the on-screen channel guide like a brick building leading to nowhere. Even the Knicks games that used to raise you off the couch a bit now only sank you deeper and deeper with the weight in a bag of Lay's, a can of Coke, and another miserable loss. Ugh, those expensive, lousy Knicks. So no, not all those pricey addictions had left you, but neither had this nightly one. And for that, dozens of dwellers of the city dark were thankful. So just like last night, and every other one for the past 6 years, it was just you and the bag of decent scraps wrapped in a Boy Scout loop gently round your wrist, off to feed the feral cats, the needful whiny things whose cries throughout Crown Heights you had finally stopped ignoring after your own kin had left you to fend for yourself. You started under your own stoop. Eliza was there at 9 p.m. sharp, her pupils gazing out like vertical headlamps through the huge crack on the fourth brick stair, a crack your son, Elliot, had made with a hammer in 94 when you told him the best place to find treasure is under people's feet. You had meant the dirt, the grass, the sand on the beach. But Elliot was a city kid, and stairs outnumbered trees in 1994 Brooklyn, so a smashing he went. And when you came home from teaching and saw the utter mess of crumbling concrete, you'd lost your temper, whacked your son around like you never said you would, and Elliot never found any gold under the stairs. But nowadays, this purring calico Eliza had a home by night. And now dinner, as you dug up a corner of a former sandwich, held it up to her nose, and she ate it right out of your giving hands. You pushed through the front gate and hooked a right, thinking you'd escaped the clockwork nagging from your neighbor upstairs, when, as if on cue, you heard, "You can't feed them like that, Jose. They come right back. You know that, right?" "Let them. I don't care," you called back. "Let them expect it. I don't care." "Yeah, but more of them. They're going to come right back. They're going to make babies and shit." Then all of a sudden, you got, "All right, good night, Maria. You know I love you." And on you walked, as Maria sucked her teeth from the windowsill of the building next to yours and resumed her neighborhood watch over you and the other misfit souls out for a stroll.
Oh, let's run off to the city, get lost in the wilderness. Take a boat down the Hudson, catch a show, drink a cigarette. Will always shine for you. Oh, they shut down all the bars over on Avenue A. And the sun knocks on the door, but he won't catch you so easy. Oh, let's run off to the city and get lost in the wilderness. Oh, let's run off to the city, get lost in a kiss. Oh, Rebecca, I knew when I met you, the day blind stars will always shine. Morning street sweepers is the only silence you get. Let's run our babe in the wilderness. Let's run our babe and get her lost in kiss. Oh, Rebecca, I knew when I met you. Oh, the day blind stars will always shine.
Pickens, Shira Elias, Scott Davis, I'm Matt Delapino. Welcome to On This Island, Episode 9.
Thank you all, first of all, for coming in, braving the rain. It's a beautiful thing to do, as I say this in wet shoes. Our first guest tonight was a recent star of Slant's most recent show, The Cloud, by Mr. Matt Moses. Her name is Polly Lee, and she'd like to tell you a little bit about her other job. Please welcome Polly Lee to the stage.
All right. Oh, hello. Okay, as you can see, my legs are shaking. I'm a little bit nervous. It's a rare day I speak for myself. As I began to look at the Jekyll and Hyde aspect of my somewhat peculiar existence, I came to the conclusion that it is the only natural way for me to exist. Let me explain. First, the Jekyll. I am Polly Lee, a theatre artist of some small repute, and my particular speciality, if you will, is developing new work. What does this mean? Basically, it means working on a befuddling, incomplete, or flawed script in an attempt to bring it closer to a production-ready draft. Sometimes, oftentimes, this means sitting around a table, reading said play, and discussing how a character feels or functions, teasing out theme and examining dramatic structure. Sometimes, this means workshopping a play on its feet. What it always means is doing the particular thing actors do without any of the fanfare or spotlight. It means no glory for me, no Tony in new work development, you'll have noticed. Often it means handing the glory over to someone else as they play the part in production. I do not feel sour grapes about this, in as much as...
Oh my God, I broke it. I'm just going to keep going. Is that all right?
Do it.
In as much as an actor has any agency in their own career, this is my chosen path. I love doing this work. It fulfills me, I adore the collaboration, and it allows me to dodge the bits that I don't like. Being wrong, being judged and scrutinized. Oh, and auditions. I fucking hate auditions. However, given that a life in the theater does not pay, and I don't think that's a big stretch, this particular cottage in the theatrical realm really doesn't pay. So, like many, many of our finest American actors, I too have a day job, which brings me to my hide. I am a porn star. If my Jekyll, as Matt introduced me, is Polly Lee, then my hide is Ashford McNair. Ashford McNabb, as you will know if you're a soccer mum or a trucker, narrates audio porn. Question, right? Well, she was named by the time-honoured frat boy equation of first street you grew up on plus first pet name equals porno star name. In my case, however, my first pet was an ill-disciplined and incontinent West Highland Terrier named Haggis McPorridge. So, in 2007, when asked by my producer what name I would like to work under, I substituted the pet name for my middle name and landed on Ashford McNabb. I have been making money with my mouth ever since. I know. As with all seemingly non-crack addict sex workers, you're wondering, who are this woman's parents? Well, my mother is a celebrated British author, one-time high society socialist, op-ed journalist, and famous feminist of questionable sexuality. My father is a recovering Anglican priest and alcoholic with a passion for throaty blondes and art history. So naturally, the theatre was the only way to go. But the audio porn, you ask, how did that come about? I too ponder this regularly, as I sit in my 4x4x8 Guantanamo Bay orange booth, alone, outsource the engineer and editor roles, in the near dark, lights must make some kind of discernible sound or something. How did this become my life? I often yell it, how did this happen to me? Because you can yell random shit in a small soundproof booth in Newark, New Jersey, and the answers come flooding in. Could it be the Jack the Ripper documentary my father and I riffed on at tea at the House of Lords? This documentary featured a prosty who would steal the rings off men's fingers with her vaginal muscles. My father and I had this hilarious running joke that she could steal anything. And so, when we were visiting my mum's cousin, the Earl of Lauderdale, we'd be all nice sugar bowl and we'd go and squat next to him. Could it be the time I came downstairs to one of my parents' dinner parties with the Bishop of London, among other dignitaries, aged 4, saying that my fufu was itchy because my mother's cock stole had melted into it? Perhaps it was because my mother was then one of 10 people to say fuck on the BBC. She was super proud of it. However it came about, prudery was never part of my life. Add to this the fact that at 15 I gave up reading all non-curriculum based materials. This was a highly effective rebellion and was ended by my mother's paying me £1 per book to read for pleasure. Obviously this sunk into my psyche and here we are today. When first offered the job, I'd imagined that I would be asked to do turn-of-the-century romances with my dulcet tones. Delightful, somewhat titillating romances between alabaster-thighed virgins and their calloused-thumbed lords. Euphemisms and chivalry, mild fautage. What I got was... your pussy lips as dark as a bulldog's nostrils. Hence the false name and a very popular sideline in texting choice quotes to certain friends. Not that I don't read the romances, they are a mainstay of my work, but since I uttered these words, at least not until after he ripped off her clothes and fucked her until she qualified for disability benefits. Into an illustrious set of 4D nominees. At this point in time, Ashford is replete with headshot. By Felicity LaFortune, an actress friend. Bio written by Alejandro Morales, a playwright friend, and an impressive listing of titles. Thanks to Ashford's prestige, my own audiobook career has skyrocketed, and Polly Lee has a burgeoning, not to be confused with Ashford, success in the tween market. But as you can hear, at some point over the past 7 years, she became her own being, my Hyde. As such, when she, sitting in the booth, gets turned on while telling of being gangbanged by a passel of one-eyed gentlemen. And that is not a euphemism. The fellows in question had each lost an eye. I have no need to feel embarrassed. She can belch her way through the phrase, she still had images of him ripping... She still had images of him ripping her clothes off and pounding her pussy like it stole money from him. And it doesn't take the intellectual integrity of my comrades on the place theatre has in the modern age. In equal parts, I gleefully anticipate and cotton-mouthedly dread the day I get recognised for her voice. This hasn't happened yet. So far, we managed to happily coexist. Ashford gives me an outlet for my inner prurience and financial support for my invisible artistry. What do I give Ashford? An emotional depth to her readings? When you're ardent Ashford fans, you'll note that she gets inexplicably choked up when pregnancy is mentioned as my husband and I struggle through the IVF process. An understanding of structure, pace, and tone? Undoubtedly, they both glean their joy from giving pleasure to others through storytelling. It does have some downsides. Last fall, I played a narcissistic Texas debutante and would have moments during the show where I would think, how am I still talking? Somebody shut me up. However, the next day, I would whisper this gem into the mic. The man's dick game was so strong that he could probably cure a bitch of scoliosis. And I would count my blessings, which obviously are myriad. At this point, I would like to bring Ashford to the stage to read to you, but she, unlike me, doesn't work in the small artsy theatres of New York. She only works when a free lunch is in the offing. Furthermore, her peignoir is locked in the bowels of Lincoln Center. Nevertheless, both she and I would feel that we were shortchanging you if we didn't share a little story for your pleasure. So, without further ado, I give you an excerpt from the dirtiest book either of us have ever read. Now I wish the mic was on, it's really good husky. The man at the bar started laughing at me, as if he knew that I was holding myself back. Then he stole my hand and pressed it on his dick. We both straightened our backs like we were bracing ourselves. All my flesh pulled towards his flesh. I gulped my drink and banged for more. More! I shouted, more, more, more. I started rubbing that guy with my fist up and down under the bar. His cock was like a hose. I wanted to hold it forever. My cunt was breathing like a small animal, begging me to do something. Let's go, I pleaded. Thank you.
Holly Lee, everybody. We'd like to present to you now a short play by writer Sharon Rothstein. It stars some stars of the New York and the regional stage, Amelia McLean, Will Rogers, and a future Obie-winning performance by our pianist, Scott Davis. Once we sort out the mics. Who took a taxi here, by the way? No, there were none to have. It's late night, / early morning on Atlantic Avenue. It's dark and quiet, the kind of quiet you rarely get in New York. Maybe we hear a whoosh of a lone green cab driving by. On the street, leaning against the window of a storefront preschool, are two Brooklyn dads in their Brooklyn dad uniforms. One of the men is asleep. The other, Mark, stares into his phone. Amelia Curell, a Brooklyn mom, runs up to the storefront. She stops, panting, when she sees the men.
Oh, hey, hi. Are you here for summer camp registration?
Brooklyn coding camp, yep.
Oh, wow. I really thought I'd be the first one.
Me too.
I mean, you think you get here at 4 a.m, you're going to be the first one.
I got here at 3:30 and there's already this guy ahead of me. Sucks.
Yeah. Remember when you used to wait in line all night to see some great band or something?
Oh, yeah. I waited all night for Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray, huh?
All night.
Wow.
Now I'm waiting so my 9-year-old can make a website or some useless app, like an app that rates how loud you belch or something.
I belch.
Right.
We're literally sitting on the street at 4 a.m. so our kids can sit in front of their computers all summer. How's that for crazy?
It's ridiculous.
So you think we'll get in?
I don't know. I heard there's really only one, maybe two spots available after they let in all the kids who have been before, who have siblings, the donor kids.
Donor kids, really?
I know, there's this lesbian couple from Carroll Gardens. They've been donating $5,000 a year since they started IVF. As if being lesbians wasn't enough. I mean, how can you compete with that?
The length some people will go to for summer camp.
It's absurd.
Totally. I mean, my kid's great.
Oh.
Sadie Hudson.
Mine too. Ollie Linus.
like I think that if she doesn't go to this camp, she'll be any less great than she already is.
Oh, of course not. Oh.
It's just that I'm pretty sure that if she doesn't get in, she'll never really amount to anything in life.
Exactly. Plus my wife. You don't get out there, you're not the first one on that line, you might as well call one of those moving companies that also packs your shit up, because you're out of here and I'm not helping you pack a single box. I think she was just joking, mostly. She has a pretty severe sense of humor.
A car slows to a stop across the street.
You think that's a cop? Oh, God, he probably thinks we're homeless.
Oh, it's Brooklyn. They must be used to this by now. My buddy sat online for 2 days just to get his son onto the waiting list for Montessori preschool. The school had actually set up a port-a-john for everyone in line. But he just used his coffee cup and a muffin wrapper.
You know, it's not like this at other places.
My sister, she's in Katona. They're begging kids to sign up for their summer camps.
Yeah, but they're not coding camps, are they? Or robot-making camp or 3D printer camp. Those kids, they're not making the future. They're making lanyards.
It's plain old summer camp for plain old kids.
Yeah, plain old stupid kids. No offense to your sister.
No, it's true. Her kids are stupid. Even the baby, you can tell he's not going to be very bright.
I guess that's why we do it, right? Why we stay. Because we know raising our kids here, as hard as it is, it's going to make them better.
That's right. Better than everyone else in America.
Except for kids from the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. They'll be the same as the kids from the Bay Area.
So who's that guy? The guy who got here first.
Kyle something. Works in finance, but like mid-level.
Not a donor.
Oh, no. His daughter's 8. Apparently, she's just like Steve Jobs. If Steve Jobs were an 8-year-old girl. And alive.
How long's he been asleep?
Pretty much since the minute I got here. Asked if I minded. Big meeting tomorrow or something.
Because he's the only one with a big meeting.
I know, right?
Doesn't seem like it should count, does it? I mean, so what if he got here at 3 in the morning? He's sleeping right through it. Hmm. For all he knows, he's lying in his bed underneath his duvet. Look at the smile on his face. It's 4 in the morning. We're sitting here shivering on Atlantic Avenue, probably about to get knifed by some lunatic. And this guy's dreaming of eating his mother's meatloaf on a sandy beach somewhere.
I did mind when he asked, but I mean, what are you gonna say?
Of course you minded. He's using you. It's fucked up. He's assuming that if something happens, there's some danger or something, you'll wake him up. You'll take care of him. It's a lot of responsibility to put on a stranger, isn't it?
If something happens?
I'm not saying something is going to happen, but if it did.
If it did.
I mean, these are the mean streets of New York. Who knows what might go down, especially since there are only 3 of us.
And only 2 spots.
2 spots, if we're lucky.
The lesbians.
The lesbians.
Should we kill them?
We could kill him. Or we could just take his wallet.
Can't put down that deposit if you don't have a wallet, huh?
$1,800 plus 15 for the t-shirts. The website says it's non-negotiable.
How do we do it?
You just lean over and pull it out of his pocket. If he wakes up, you pretend you were falling asleep on him. Like, hey, I'm only human. I fell asleep too.
Hey, I'm only human. Oh, I like it. But why does it have to be me?
He's already seen you. He knows you're sitting right next to him. Plausible deniability.
It's true. All right. So we've got a plan.
Got a plan.
Oh, man. Living in this town makes you think of some nutso things, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh. But I don't think we're nuts. I think there's nothing like raising your kids in New York to teach you the simple, brutal truth that there are a finite amount of resources in the world. Not everyone can make it. Maybe if we'd gotten here a little earlier, just half an hour earlier, our kids could have invented the next crazy birds, but it's too late now. Too late for my Sadie. Too late for your Ollie. Unless? No, forget it. It's just camp.
Right.
Let's just sit here and wait. I'm sure your wife will understand.
So I just lean over.
Mark starts to lean against the sleeping man.
Now what?
Put your hand in his pocket.
I'm putting my hand in his pocket.
Just gently.
Have you done this before?
There's not a hipster mom in South Brooklyn who didn't steal a thong or two in her day. You're almost there.
I got it! I got his wallet!
Shh, wait.
I can't believe I did.
High five.
Oh. Now we just have to wait 5 hours.
Just 5 hours. Just sit here and act cool.
Yeah, right. The new number one and number two.
That's right. Oh, and if I get rid of you, I'm the new number one.
What?
I'm kidding, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's just summer camp. Right?
End of play. Thank you, Sharon Rothstein, for the beautiful play. And thank you, Will Rogers, Amelia McLean, and Scott Davis, wearing multiple hats tonight. Up ahead was an abandoned old brownstone just before Franklin Avenue. Graffiti on the plywood and bushes overgrown. It was a ragged holdout from the old Crown Heights. But you knew a slot through a fence and wedged your 50-year-old frame between it, and then, like waking a sleepy lover, they purred. You knew each of their cries distinctly. Denton and Abby's low groans, the more wheezy meows of Josie and Ira, and then Ian and Freddie keening unseen until you said, "Hey, babies, come out, babies." And soon enough, they nudged their heads out into the coating street lamplight, and a new kitten was here. Still in the shadows, its speckled brow a sure sign that Josie had finally weaned a survivor from that insane winter of searching high and low for a Tom to keep her warm through the half year of snow. On your old radio that morning, you had heard a report about the swelling numbers of feral cats in Brooklyn. It was a new program to you, a new station even. A school colleague had recommended WNYC in the mornings after you complained way too many times about WFAN, the local sports station that gave you some solace each day after the Knicks blew another 20-point lead at home. It comforted you to listen to some fat man behind a microphone vocally shame the team as other men from all corners of the city called in and echoed his drastic punishment in a strange kind of group therapy for guys who couldn't admit any weakness apart from their choice of ball club. And when a chorus of radio boos from around the city hit a tipping point, boiling down to the diamond-cut conclusion that the Knicks suck, you took a breath and you actually felt better. But this morning, and for the last few months, it was the public affairs show on WNYC. A slight turn of the dial made you a cultured man. The sounds of white people boringly opining about zoning laws or the new elegance of food trucks made you feel like a thoughtful member of this island. Today's polite chat centered on the swarming felines of Brooklyn, as a well-intentioned woman recommended a city initiative to catch and spay these creatures, controlling their population and preserving the New Brooklyn. "New Brooklyn? What the fuck is that?" you said out loud to no one in particular. The sweet lady on the public affairs show assured the host that she loved cats. Oh, absolutely love them. The catch and control plan was only in their best interest. But never did she mention finding a home for them, a friend, a meal, so they didn't starve to death. That part of it was up to you. And that part seemed most essential for any living thing to have a decent day. The purring behind the fence, now reduced to quiet sounds of mouths chewing, you wedged back out through the plywood door and back out onto the street. You turned right at the top of Washington Avenue and were reminded of the hilly texture of the city as you watched the avenue roll downhill toward a perfect little wedge of a Manhattan skyline. That view never got old for you. Even on the bad days, when you and the teenage Elliot had screamed your lungs out across the kitchen all night, when his report card couldn't even eke out the dignity of a C. When Elliot's sister, Flora, had finally had enough of being the good sibling, the ignored daughter, and started bringing home strange men for dinner who were just shades younger than you. Even when your wife, Anna, had found out about the weekly trysts between you and Maria from next door and then tossed your wardrobe out into the street till you slept, on an Eastern Parkway bench one night on a bed of your old clothes. Even then, that look from the top of Washington Avenue always inspired some childlike yearning to just roll onto your side and tumble all the way down the 2 mile hill, spilling yourself out into the cold East River.
Speculations too slow to react. Oh, honey, don't show up to lose or win. Bend the rules. He's a Harvard degree. I can't seem to grasp the simple things, the fruit of his labor or the pursuit of his dreams. Oh, honey, don't show up to lose or win. Bend the rules. Junior tries to fill his daddy's shoes with so much expectation, too much dedication. No wonder honey's humming the blues. No wonder honey's humming the blues. Chasing the sun when you can't look at the moon. Oh, honey, don't show up to lose. No way, bend the rules. Oh, honey, don't show up to lose. No way, bend the rules. He's been searching night and day just to find he was always own way, and he's been looking day and night just to find we don't always have to be right. Jack Honey Jr. tries to fit his daddy's shoes with so much expectation, too much dedication. No wonder honey's humming the blues. No wonder honey's humming the blues. Now honey, go and bend all the rules. Now honey, go and bend all the rules.
It seems like a good time to mention that the incredible visuals you've been seeing so far, and a lot that you will continue to see, are by a longtime friend of Slant, Essie Klempner, who is out in the house today somewhere. That is her. So thank you, Essie, for donating your beautiful work to us. Our next guest, I believe, is here after a bit of an ordeal that I have to explain. He spent the weekend at Comerica Park in Detroit, Michigan, doing a fantasy baseball camp. He actually sent me a video of him at bat in a Tigers uniform, and the back said Pearlstein, number 15, I think. And number 5, I'm sorry. And off in the dugout, shouting, "Let's go, Pearlstein, let's go, Pearlstein, hit it out," was none other than 80s pitcher Frank Tanana. Thank you. You had that baseball card too. He has bent the rules, he has bent time, he flew into Philadelphia because there were no flights into New York from Detroit today. So, Randy Pearlstein, via sea, via air, via land, welcome him to the stage, please.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Matt. Hey, everybody, how are you? Hey, I'm a little bit injured. so I'm going to be moving slow. But not bad for 43, right? Not bad. For those of you that don't know me, and most of you don't know me, last year and a half or 2 years, I've been traveling all over the world. Recently, I've been in, just this year, Norway and Denmark and Iceland and Poland and Hungary, Detroit, and I'm sharing some of my pictures and my stories on social media, Instagram, Twitter. My handle is @randazzles if you want to see some of the images and the stories. I was asked tonight to come here and read one of my reviews, which was my review of the new Yankee Stadium, which I'm happy to do. And I don't say this to be maudlin or to kiss up or anything like that, but I was just, you know, looking at the crowd back there, and this is a really good-looking crowd. You guys are really exceptionally good-looking, not to kiss up. So this is my review from my Tumblr. I will read it verbatim. My review of the new Yankee Stadium. Here we go. Woo. The new Yankee Stadium. Review and fiction. The old Yankee Stadium first opened its doors in 1923. Across the street sits the new Yankee Stadium. Is newer better? Is it worse? Do we go for the stadium or for the sport? Or is it the company? I wonder sometimes if memories of a physical space are somewhat dependent on who else was there. Why do so many men cry in the movies when the kid wants to have a catch with his dad? I know many people long for the past. They say the new stuff just isn't the same. Tell me about it. My first real girlfriend, steady girlfriend, was my favorite place to find myself when I was 19. If I could be there, I was. I followed her every move, I knew her lucky number, and I wore her shirts. If style is important, I loved her style. When she was kissed and it got her just on the right spot, she said, "Yikes." The word would last longer than you thought it would. Yikes. I am no longer within the confines of her loving embraces, and I do miss her. I have thought about the idea of lasting memories and making new memories. My first days at New York's historic Yankee Stadium were during my college years. Those memories, like you would imagine, burn deep. Going to a game today with a close friend, well, the new memories don't quite hold the same way. It is important, they say, that Babe Ruth played at the old Yankee Stadium. So did Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio and John Olerud. Does that mean something? Why? They never cheered for us. The past looms so large sometimes and seems so quite important. As an experiment, I filmed myself having sex with a wonderful woman I know. One night we filmed in color, another night in black and white. I had wondered if the black and white would make things more nostalgic, or more professional, or more historical, or more formidable. Ultimately, it didn't make any difference. It was the same players and the same friendship and the same few moves I know. I really like being close with May Rose. That is her name. She's in a roller derby league and she eats vegan. She is nice and gentle with me, and I am with her as well. I've seen too many times fathers yelling at baseball players from the stands. These middle management guys shouting critiques at the pros. They tend to yell way too loud and for far too long. I know they want some attention, and I believe that's okay. We all do that from time to time. But the kids are rarely leaning over, shouting, "You tell them, Dad, let them have it." These dads miss a bond that is there and in play. These kids feel the relationship next to them and can't figure out why the adults are leaning outside of it. It's important to create new things. Moving forward is exciting, yet often at a great spiritual expense. Baseball is an outdoor sport. It was invented to be played during the day. For a whole century, it was played during the day. Baseball and sunshine, not rain, but sunshine, were always together. A night game was not played at the old Yankee Stadium until 1946. That's when they first had lights. On May 24th, 1935, the first night game was played in Cincinnati. The president threw out a ceremonial first pitch, and Thomas Edison oversaw the invention of the lights, and people who worked could now buy tickets to come at night, and everyone got rich. The night game was a rarity, and now it is the standard. People thought the night crowds would create more crime. Some teams refused to play at night, including Brooklyn. Why were people so reticent to move forward? Because change often seems unnatural. The new thing is not the old thing, and the old thing was how we always did it, so if you want to change it, we're going to have a problem. Together, we help each other change, and together we celebrate our traditions. A stadium is kind of like a temple. A relationship is like a cathedral. This is not my metaphor, but these places are holy, and the pillars, like people, work together to keep the institution strong. That is May Rose's metaphor. She's behind me now with her hands on my shoulders, wondering when we can go to the park and sit in the new summer sun. I love the new Yankee Stadium. Every seat is a good one. I think I like the architecture, although the old one was more neat to the eye. I've sat in the bleachers, and I've sat in the third row behind the plate. The new players have some pop, and Derek Jeter is still out there. And when you look around, you see the fans have evolved from the doorknobs of the 1970s who would throw batteries at the opposing team's outfielders to a more friendly and respectable folk. I've been three times with my pal Matt. I've been one time with my mentor, Mr. Altman. And once I was there on a date that didn't quite work out. If I could make the new memories as deep as I used to in my youth, I certainly would. The highlights, well, I recall me and Matt hollering from the bleachers for Mariano to air it out. Mr. Altman had tickets in the third row where we had our own fancy waiter. In each case, I was with friends, moving to the music, sitting in that warm, fuzzy bubble, having drifted away from the city. And of course, there was beautiful Chrissy. So beautiful. She was shy, having been hurt by too many guys. She only wanted to be friends. I agreed, of course. We're still pals. In fact, she set me up with Mayrose. I have to go. Yankee Stadium, home to the New York Yankees. 1 East 161st Street, the Bronx, New York. NewYorkYankees.com, MLB.com/NYY/ballpark.
Randy Perlstein, everyone. Thank you, Randy. Our final guest of the night is a playwright we've worked with. He, in fact, wrote the play The Classroom, directed by Laurie Walter Hudson, we did a few years ago. Please welcome to the stage with his story, starring Bruce Dern as the Angel of Death, a memoir by Craig Clary.
I had had hemorrhoids for years. Massive, bleeding hemorrhoids. On a bad day, the toilet bowl looked like that elevator in The Shining. Those of you who are squeamish about this sort of thing, it's only going to get worse. I saw my doctor, and I explained the problem to him in a lot more detail than I will share with you now. He thought this might be something more than hemorrhoids. He's a young guy, the doctor. All the doctors in this story are young. That's the thing about going through a health scare like this when you're 34. You're young enough that you're still young, but you're old enough to have doctors who are younger than you are. Anyway, the doctor recommended that I have a colonoscopy. If you've never had one, the day before is the worst part. You can't eat, can't drink much except Gatorade, and you push so many laxatives through your system that by the end of the night, your bowel movements are like, you know, it occurs to me I can probably tell this story without that part. I wasn't expecting to hear much, except, yeah, you've got really bad hemorrhoids. Then the doctor who did the colonoscopy, and who was even younger than the first doctor, asks my wife and me to go into a little room for a talk. Now, this room is odd because it's really only been designed to serve one purpose, so that a very nice young doctor can tell you that he's found something and that it doesn't look good. In my case, it was a very large tumor. At its largest circumference, it was blocking about 85% of my colon. They were still doing biopsies, but he'd seen this sort of thing before, and 9 times out of 10. So he'd already made a call and scheduled a CT scan of my whole body for the next night to see if anything had spread. As we left the room, my wife hugged the nice young doctor. She would later tell me that she felt ridiculous hugging this man that she had known for about 8 minutes, but to me it made perfect sense. So I did the CT scan, and we just had to wait. The scan was late in the evening, and after we left, we just had to get food at the first place we found. Chipotle. Call this an unfortunate byproduct of having my CT scan at 9 o'clock at night. Medical clinics and hospitals, as I would find out, have a very unique feeling at nighttime. There's a calm, workmanlike vibe around the place. The fancy doctors have taken their fancy ideas home for the night, and only the night staff is there, tasked with quietly taking care of only the absolute necessities. Before I forget, in retrospect, yes, I realize that Chipotle seems like a ludicrous dinner choice, given what was going on in my digestive system. We might have even made jokes about that at the time. I can't really be sure. I do remember a lot of jokes about shaving my head and selling crystal meth. But then I got a phone call that told me my Heisenberg aspirations might need to wait. The biopsies were benign. My doctor was confused. If it wasn't cancer, he had no idea what else was causing it. I was now a special case, and ambitious young doctors love special cases. He thought of everything, and we tested for everything. Did you know that there are small parasites that can crawl up into your rectum and lay eggs? And to test for this, you just take a simple piece of scotch tape and... Sorry. It's a story about my colon, you know? Sometimes it's not always pretty. I'll try to keep that stuff to a minimum. The parasite test came back negative, and we never figured anything else out, but for now, at least, it didn't much matter. The tumor was big enough that it had to be cut out either way. So I had the surgery, it went fine, I was in the hospital for a few days, some friends came to see me, I had just had a third of my colon removed, blah, blah, blah. That part of the story is pretty much like any other hospital story. I did luck out in that they gave me my own room with a nice view, and they rolled in a cot that my wife could sleep on. Which she did, every night. One of the nights, a night nurse came in who was a young guy. And not like the doctors from before. I mean, this guy was, he looked like he was 18. He was clearly new at this, but he had a nice calm demeanor that suited his profession well. We talked for a few minutes about what it was like to work the night shift. I told him about an R.E.M. song called Day Sleeper, about a guy who works the night shift and how it leaves him with this sense that daytime and nighttime just sort of bleed together into shades of gray. I was on a lot of drugs, and looking back, I probably sounded a little loopy. He smiled politely. He was humoring me. I mean, it was possible that he didn't know who the hell R.E.M. was, but still, I was glad I had told him about the song, and I went to sleep confident that I had given this kid a solid music tip and that someday he'd thank me. The third and final night that I was in the hospital, I had a dream. In it, I was visited by the actors Bruce Dern and Frank Langella. They had both been on my mind recently. Langella, because I was sad that I had missed his King Lear, which I heard was excellent. And Dern, because I had been hearing about his excellent performance in a movie called Nebraska, and I had been a fan of Dern's for years. In my dream, Langella didn't say anything, as best I remember. But Dern spoke to me with all the gravitas and severity that he usually has. All these doctors and all these other people, Bruce Dern said, they're all telling you that you're going to be fine, that everything's okay. I'm paraphrasing that part because, as is often the case with dreams, I don't remember everything word for word. But the last thing Bruce Dern said to me, I don't need to paraphrase. I remember it clear as day. You know. This is cancer, and that it's going to kill you. I woke up. I looked across the room at the cot where my wife was still sleeping. I looked above her at my nice view out the window where the sun was just starting to come up over Queens. They say sunlight is the best disinfectant. I always loved that phrase. Usually the unyielding light of day makes a weird dream seem a little less weird. Not this time. Later that morning, before I was discharged, one of the surgeons came in to check on me. He talked to me about my tumor, how he had held it in his hand, and how it sure looked a lot like cancer. The biopsies had been benign, sure, but those were only small samples, and now that they had the whole thing, they could really tell for sure. Also, there was a chance some of the cancer cells might have made their way to surrounding areas, so there was mention of light radiation, some chemotherapy, but you probably won't lose your hair or anything. My head was spinning. Oh my God, Bruce Dern was right. The doctor left. I grabbed my wife's hand, and I cried. I almost told her about the dream, but I couldn't. I looked out the window again towards Queens. That had been our old stomping ground. The first place we lived in New York. We lived there for almost a decade. I wondered if we would still be living in New York in another decade. I wondered if I would still be alive in another decade. Ugh, I'm sorry. I sort of can't believe I actually wrote that last part. I'm sorry for going all maudlin on you, but if you think about what was going on, it's kind of hard not to. I'll try to work in another poop story soon. We went home, and for the second time in a month, I sat waiting for a phone call to tell me whether or not I had colon cancer. I called the doctor because he told me to report to him about how things were passing through my reconstructed colon. See, I told you, more poop stuff. And while he was on the phone, he told me that he had just received some test results, so he put me on hold. I was writing down everything because I was on a lot of Percocet and I was scared I wouldn't remember it all. He got back on the line, and as he talked, I wrote in huge letters, "Not malignant." I pointed to it so my wife would see. The phone call ended, and I leaned my head into her and I started to cry. Suck it, Bruce Dern. I am going to live. I took this opportunity to tell my wife about the Bruce Dern dream, including the bit about Frank Langella, who, while he didn't say anything, was still very memorable because he's just that good. It's true. So now here I am tonight. The dream was just a dream, and now I'm awake. And alive for the foreseeable future. And it's time to move on. After you face complicated issues of life and death, what's the first thing you should do to move on? Naturally, you should tell these intimate details to a theater full of strangers. But of course, not all of you are strangers. I see some familiar faces, and that's part of moving on, too. Remembering not to take any of you for granted, to make time for you, talk to you, tell you a joke, ask you how your day was. I have just had a piece of myself removed in the literal sense, and the power of that metaphor is not lost on me. I have to take inventory on all the parts that I still have left. Great family, great friends, and a partner to share my life with who did more to put me back together than any 28-year-old doctor ever could. And if that's too sappy for you, I will remind you that I started this whole story by talking about my bleeding hemorrhoids. So, I could have made a worse choice for the ending. After all, I totally left out some of the grosser anecdotes. For instance, if a doctor ever needs a stool sample and you can't produce right away, take my advice. Wait for it. Do not let him send you home with a little cup and tell you to come back with a specimen. The way you are going to feel on that bus ride back to his office. Well, that's a whole other story. By the way, I still haven't seen Nebraska. I hear it's pretty good, right? I feel like I could probably watch it now. It might have been weird at first, but I feel ready. After all, sooner or later, we all have to make our peace with Bruce Dern.
Greg Clary, everyone. Your last stop tonight was the fire escape over on St. John's Avenue, next to an oil drum barbecue left out from the good weather weekend just passed. The cats here were a new gang, young and still unsure of you. A neighbor friend had called it in fact. And with newbies, you took a passive approach, just dropping a handful of day-old bread underneath the oil drum and letting them help themselves. When the keening from the fire escape overhead kicked in, it was your cue to leave. You took a few steps away and then peeked back to make sure, and yes, a family of four had leapt straight down from the second floor to get to work. The acrobatics of cats always pleased you. Swift, decisive, and such soft steps as to never even leave a trace, like they were never even there at all. You called this gang the Acrocats. It was a work in progress. As you walked away, a sweet, pale-skinned couple came across the scene. The thick-rimmed, glass-wearing beau of the two asked, "Hey, man, you know those cats?" "Nah, man, but if I don't feed them, no one will." "Oh, that's so sweet," the girlfriend chimed in. "Isn't that amazing?" The boyfriend nodded, "Really is, man, really beautiful." "Hey, you have a good night." And off the sweet couple went toward Franklin Avenue, off to the new slow food place where they'd spend $100 for a Tuesday night dinner, before retiring to their renovated two-bedroom with new floors, a gleaming fridge, and multiple locks on the doors. And you, with your feeding rounds now finished, called it a night. Summer school was only summery by name. The hours were no different than fall, winter, and spring school, only the kids were a bit more ornery. But you needed the extra cash for your ex-wife, Anna, upstate, for Flora in Atlanta with her 50-year-old husband, and for Elliot, finishing up a stay in that private island at the north end of the East River. You passed out on the couch, the TV beaming the 6th rerun of Nick highlights from MSG, where Mello had actually found a way to lift his battalion of fools to victory. As the daylight broke around 5 a.m., and a morning breeze whispered in through the open window, you snored away as they all came in. Eliza at first, quiet as a shadow, and then Denton and Abby, ever a pair. Behind them was Josie after a restless night, and then Ira behind her, Ian and Freddie too. And then the new clan from the fire escape, all of them came, each with soft, invisible steps, until they surrounded your sleeping self and waited. Like vestiges of the night before, now your new children of the day, hungry and waiting for you to wake.
Night and day.
Randy Pearls.
Epstein, Craig Clary, Essie Klempner, Isabella Bird on the lights, Shira Elias on the vocals, Scott Davis on the keys, Phil Pickens on guitar and vocals. On behalf of Slam Theater Project, Adam Knight, Wes Grantham, Matt Smart, I'm Matt Delapina. Thank you for coming to On This Island. Take it away.